Welcome to the Mind Renewed.
They're so worried that they've got to take over down here the direction of where it's going and get a one world system together. Get rid of nationalities and get one government, one religion, so we won't have war. That's the effort of man to bring about his own salvation.
Hello everyone, Julian Charles here of the mindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Now the first thing I guess I need to do today is to apologise for the fact that there was no podcast last week. That particular week was half term when, as long-time listeners to the Mind Renewed will certainly very well know by now, I tend not to get all that much done at the Mind Renewed. Well, actually, I don't get much done at all during times like that. But unfortunately, there's also a problem this week. It just so happens that the interview that I had planned to go out this weekend has had to be postponed indefinitely. I'm afraid. I had hoped to be speaking with David Conn of TruthSleuth.net for what I hoped was going to be a fairly in-depth discussion on the so-called People's Temple of the Disciples of Christ, best known, I guess, because of its founder Jim Jones, whose grotesque leadership, of course, led to almost 1,000 people being murdered in 1978 in Northwest Guyana. And David Conn is certainly the go-to person on this subject because he investigated Jim Jones for something like 8 years prior to that Jonestown massacre. Unfortunately, however, David Conn is currently unwell. He had hoped still to be able to come on the show, but I received an email a few days ago saying that unfortunately he does feel that it's necessary to postpone for the foreseeable future. So please do consider joining me in praying for David Conn for his swift recovery, and God willing, we may be fortunate enough to speak with him at a later date. So in its place, I have another guest episode up my sleeve that I'd like to share with you, which I had hoped to post last week during that half term, but just didn't get round to it. And this time it's an address by David Thoreau, who is founder, president and CEO of the Independent Institute in the US. And just to put you in the picture about the Independent Institute, let me quote from some of their description. It's a non-profit, non-partisan, scholarly research and educational organization, and it has a mission to advance peaceful, prosperous, and free societies grounded in a commitment to human worth and dignity. And in addition to heading up the Independent Institute, David Thoreau is also founder and president of the C.S. Lewis Society of California. And it was in that capacity that he gave this address, which I'm sharing with you today, which I think is a very informative and thought-provoking talk. And it's called C.S. Lewis on Mere Liberty and the Evils of Statism, which David Thoreau gave as the keynote talk at the first annual conference of Christians for Liberty at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas, on the 2nd of August 2014. Now, C.S. Lewis, of course, as we all know, was that very famous author of the Chronicles of Narnia, but he was also an Oxford and Cambridge don in medieval and Renaissance literature, and also a philosopher and theologian who wrote many books and articles and gave lectures and radio broadcasts in the area of Christian apologetics, which is not about apologizing, as the word might suggest, but about defending and commending the Christian faith. And indeed, he is very widely considered to be one of the most significant Christian apologists of the 20th century. And some of his work in this area is still gaining the attention of philosophers and theologians today, such as Dr. Angus Manouge, of course, who we had as a guest on the show a few months ago, talking about libertarian free will. And what I take from David Thoreau's address here is, I think he demonstrates from his clearly extensive knowledge of Lewis's work the extent to which C.S. Lewis was really a critic of statism. Not just that he was by nature sceptical of governments and politicians in general, which apparently he was, but that Lewis was fundamentally opposed to technocracy, that unholy alliance of the modern state with modern science or scientism, which we've been looking at on the show so much, with all its bombastic promises of being able to sort out all of our problems, national, international, bring about peace, social justice and the like, you know, through essentially programs of control. Because that necessarily erodes our rights and our freedoms. But perhaps even more importantly, treads that path of redefining our humanity so that we're no longer seen as individuals made in the image of God, with all the dignity and responsibility that that entails, but rather something more like human resources or human phenomena to be organised and administered and manipulated for the so-called good of the collectivist whole. And this, of course, fits in with many themes that we've been considering at TMR over the last couple of years. And as David Thoreau explains, it was Lewis's worldview that motivated that critique, a worldview centred in Christian theism, in which the fundamental political reality is the human individual, the child of God, the human being made in the image of God, who stands under universal moral law and truth as grounded in the Creator. As Thoreau puts it, let me quote here because I think this is an excellent quote. Throughout his work, Lewis infused an interconnected worldview that championed objective truth, moral ethics, natural law, literary excellence, reason, science, individual liberty, personal responsibility and virtue, and Christian theism. In so doing, he critiqued naturalism, reductionism, nihilism, positivism, scientism, historicism, collectivism, atheism, statism, coercive egalitarianism, militarism, welfareism, and dehumanization and tyranny of all forms, end quote. Now, that is certainly a mouthful, I do admit, but I think it does give you an idea of what's in store with this address. Now, my knowledge of Lewis's work is very much more limited than that. I have benefited from some of his writings, especially his book Mere Christianity, which I read in the 1980s and which did actually play some part in my coming to faith in Christ around that time. Yeah, that I am that old. That gives it away, but I am that old. But I certainly hadn't picked up on all the themes that David Thoreau identifies here in this talk. So it is a fascinating address, not just because it illuminates important aspects of Lewis's thought, but that it also argues, in a world in which Christianity and the state are too often seen as natural allies, that in fact what we might call libertarian values are essentially consistent with Christian thought. And I do think that is true. Which is not to say that Lewis himself identified as a libertarian, but clearly much of his thought could be described as libertarian-like. Neither is it to say that I would agree necessarily with everything that Lewis ever wrote. As I've already said, I haven't read everything. I've read a good deal of that he wrote that I haven't read. I'm just offering this as something that I found very interesting, very worthwhile listening to, that fits in with many of the things that we've been working at here at TMR, especially after about halfway through, listening out for many of those themes coming through in the talk. And in fact, I would say it's probably worth listening to more than once, maybe several times, in fact, because I think there's so much in this to take in. So that's it for now. I shall say one or two things after this talk and Q&A, but for now, all that remains for me to say is the recording you're about to listen to is copyright the C.S. Lewis Society of California, all rights reserved. It's used here with kind permission, and I leave you in the capable hands of David Thoreau.
Well, thank you, Norman. It's a real pleasure to be here, really an honor. And it's great to see the turnout for this first Christians for Liberty conference. It's really exciting, and I think it's going to lead to all sorts of great things. Most of you, I assume, know a little bit about C.S. Lewis, and that's the topic of my talk today. Incidentally, we have a table out here in the lobby, and you can find a longer discussion of what I'm going to be talking about there as a article by me, you're welcome to have, and other articles and other materials. C.S. Lewis on Mere Liberty and the Evils of Statism. For decades, many Christians and non-Christians, both conservative and liberal, have unfortunately embraced an ill-conceived progressive, i.e. authoritarian view of supporting intrusive government powers as an unquestionable and even sanctified calling for both domestic and international affairs. In doing so, they've abandoned the Judeo-Christian natural law tradition in moral ethics and economics. In contrast, the Oxford-Cambridge scholar and best-selling author C.S. Lewis did not suffer such delusions. Despite the gigantic and deeply disturbing events that he lived through, including the rise of total war, the total state, and genocide that developed during his lifetime. Lewis's aversion to government was clearly revealed in 1951 When Winston Churchill, within weeks after he gained office as Prime Minister of Great Britain, wrote to Lewis, offering to have him knighted as commander of the Order of the British Empire, Lewis, however, flatly denied the offer because he, unlike the progressives, was never interested in politics and was deeply skeptical of government power and politicians. He expressed this further in the first two lines of his poem entitled Lines During a General Election. Quote, "Their threats are terrible enough, but we could bear all that. It is their promises that bring despair," unquote. Lewis had actually held this view for many years. In 1940, he had written a letter to his brother Warren stating, "Could we start a stagnation party, which at general elections would boast that during its term of office, no event of the least importance had taken place," unquote. He further noted, quote, "I was by nature against government," unquote. Now, this is in direct contrast to such contemporary progressive Christians as Jim Wallis, Tony Campolo, Ronald Sider, and Brian McLaren, to name a few, who clamor for what I believe is foolish and disastrous notions of achieving social justice through gigantic government powers. In contrast, one of our senior fellows, Robert Higgs, has done a pioneering book that some of you may have heard of called Crisis and Leviathan, which refutes the entire progressive myth in American history. And we have copies that you're welcome to examine at our table. But the question is, and this is the suggestion of progressives, was Lewis just ignorant or naive about modern realities? Or was he aiming at a deeper and more significant purpose in his views of government power? Lewis was unquestionably and profoundly interested in the ideas and institutions that were the basis of free and virtuous individuals and communities. But he was not at all interested in partisanship or campaign politics. He instead focused on first principles, and public policy matters were of interest only as they pertained to questions of enduring value. As a result of this focus, whereas the work of most modern scholars and other writers quickly becomes dated and obsolete, Lewis' work has actually achieved increasing timelessness and relevance. His books continue to sell at increasing and astounding rates. And although Lewis is best known for his fiction, he also wrote superb books in philosophy and theology, literary history and criticism, poetry and autobiography, as well as, at last count, 50,000 letters to individuals worldwide. Incidentally, Lewis never used a typewriter. He wrote using an ink dip pen. So he would dip the pen, write 5 words, and then dip it again. So imagine writing 50,000 letters. And the only reason we know it's 50,000 is because people have sent them back. So we have no idea exactly how many letters, because there were no copy machines, there were no carbon copies back then. Throughout his work, Lewis was infused, an interconnected worldview that championed objective truth, moral ethics, natural law, literary excellence, reason, science, individual liberty, personal responsibility and virtue, and Christian theism. In so doing, he critiqued naturalism, reductionism, nihilism, positivism, scientism, historicism, collectivism, statism, coercive egalitarianism, militarism, welfareism, and dehumanization and tyranny in almost every form. Unlike progressive crusaders for predatory government power over the peaceful pursuits of innocent people, Lewis noted that, quote, "I do not like the pretensions of government, the grounds on which it demands my obedience. It is pitched too high. I don't like the medicine man's magical pretensions, nor the Bourbon's divine right. This is not solely because I disbelieve in magic and in Boisseau's politique. I believe in God, but I detest theocracy. For every government consists of mere men and is strictly viewed a makeshift. If it adds to the command, 'Thus saith the Lord,' it lies. And it lies dangerously," unquote. Lewis addressed not only the evils of totalitarianism as manifested in fascism and communism, but the more subtle forms that face us on a daily basis, including the manifestations and influence of the welfare, therapeutic, nanny, and scientific states. Of all tyrannies, he stated, a tyranny exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, his cupidity may at some point be satiated, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, and they do so with approval of their own conscience. They may be more likely to make a hell on earth. This very kindness stings with intolerable insult. To be cured against one's will and cured of states which may not be regarded as disease is to put us on a level of those who have not yet reached the age of reason, or those who never will, to be classified with infants, imbeciles, and domestic animals, unquote. Throughout his books, he defended the rights and sanctity of individuals against tyranny, and not just because he opposed evil, but because he considered a life in freedom, including both social and economic freedom, to be essential. Quote, I believe a man is happier, and happier in a richer way, if he had the freeborn life, the freeborn mind. But I doubt whether he can have this without economic independence, which the new society is abolishing. For economic independence allows an education not controlled by government. In an adult life, it is the man who needs and asks nothing of government, who can criticize its acts and snap his fingers at its ideology, unquote. As Rodney Stark discusses in his book, The Victory of Reason, Cicero and others had contemplated the concept of the self or individualism and free will before the Christian era. But it was not until Jesus personally asserted in words and deeds the concept of universal moral equality before and responsibility to God, and not until Christian theologians made it an essential feature of their doctrine that the rights of each and every individual were championed and slavery was condemned. The world had universal slavery. This bold advance in thinking arose in part from the revolutionary insight of what's called methodological individualism in the study of human behavior, wherein the individual is considered primary. As John Elster notes, quote, the elementary unit of social life is individual human action. To explain social institutions and social change is to show how they arise as a result of actions and interactions of individuals. This view, often referred to as methodological individualism, is, in my view, trivially true, unquote. The Austrian school economist Murray Rothbard similarly wrote, quote, the fundamental reason then for the study of man is the existence of individual consciousness. And by that he means not materialism, but consciousness. Ludwig von Mises further stated that, quote, the collective has no existence and reality, but in the actions of individuals. It comes into existence by ideas that move individuals to behave as members of a definite group and goes out of existence when the persuasive power of these ideas subsides. And Stark has pointed out that although almost every other early culture and religion viewed human society in terms of the tribe, the polis, the collective, quote, it is the individual who was the focus of Christian political thought, and this in turn explicitly shaped the views of later European political philosophers, unquote. This focus produced a radical change in the world where, despite notable but limited exceptions of political decentralization, slavery, as I mentioned before, and nearly universal unyielding despotism had ruled. People were treated as mere members of a group without rights. With Christianity, each and every person is a child of God or a holy object who has free will and is individually responsible for the choices he or she makes. In this tradition, Thomas Aquinas stated, quote, a man can direct and govern his own actions also. Therefore, the rational creature, i.e. man, men and women, participates in the divine providence, not only in being governed by the natural law, but also in governing, unquote. Working from this Christian background, Lewis stressed the importance of the natural law of moral ethics, a code of moral conscience that is inescapable and defines each person as human. Such morality exists on its own, independent of subjective choices or experiences, just as one may grasp the inherent truism of mathematics or natural physical laws such as gravity. Lewis drew on the natural law insights of such thinkers as the Apostle Paul, Augustine, Magnus, Aquinas, Cicero, Grotius, Blackstone, Acton, and Locke, and he considered modernist dismissals of such work to be fundamentally erroneous. In particular, both Aquinas' notion of common sense, as described in his book, The Summa Theologica, and the legacy of rational theism found in Jewish, Islamic, Christian, and certain pagan writers, the core philosophical system that became the West, had a powerful effect on Lewis. Now remember, Lewis was a scholar in medieval and Renaissance literature. To him, the culture of modernism is not just an historical aberration of this common sense, but a profound threat to the pursuit of truth, goodness, and civilization itself. This common sense, or Lewis's notion of common rationality, consisted in part of each individual human being's intrinsic understanding of an objective, universal, and natural legal order of truth and morality. The natural law, or what Lewis called the Tao. Not Taoism, but the Tao as in the way, or the truth. Each person discerns, chooses, and acts within the Tao. For Lewis, each individual responds to and can come to know and experience this external reality of truth. It is a common knowledge. This insight, incidentally, is similar to Adam Smith's view, as he expressed in his 1759 book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, that individuals are born with an innate moral conscience and sympathy for the well-being of others and can maintain them by following the natural law. Lewis likewise claimed that, quote, if a man will go into a library and spend a few days with the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, he will soon discover the massive unanimity of the practical reason of man. From the Babylonian hymn to Samos, from the laws of Manu, the Book of the Dead, the Analects of Confucius, the Stoics, the Platonists, from Australian Aborigines, he will collect the same triumphantly monotonous denunciations of oppression, murder, treachery, and falsehood. The same injunctions of kindness to the aged, the young and the weak, of almsgiving, and impartiality and honesty. He may be a little surprised, I certainly was, as Lewis continued, to find that precepts of mercy are more frequent than justice. But he will no longer doubt that there is a thing as the law of nature. The pretense that we are presented with a mere chaos, no outline of universally accepted values, is simply false and should be contradicted in season and out season wherever it is met. Far from finding a chaos, we find exactly what we should expect if good is indeed something objective and reason the organ by whereby it is apprehended, unquote. Lewis noted that what is common to all these concepts is something crucial. Lewis again, quote, it is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false, to the kind of thing the universe is, the kind of things we are. No emotion in itself is a judgment. In that sense, all emotions and sentiments are illogical, but they can be reasonable or unreasonable as they conform to reason or fail to conform. The heart never takes the place of the head, but it can and should obey it, unquote. Lewis argued that a natural moral law is known to all, and this natural moral code is inescapable. It is basic for all moral judgments. Its foundational truths, such as caring for others is a good thing, good should be done and evil avoided, dying for a righteous cause is a noble thing, are understood regardless of experience, just as we know that 2 plus 2 equals 4. As the Apostle Paul stated, quote, when Gentiles do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences are also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them, unquote. In his book, The Discarded Image, Lewis showed that Paul's statement completely conforms with the view that morality is determined by right reason, or the Stoic idea of natural law. Quote, the Stoics believe in a natural law which all rational men, in virtue of their rationality, saw to be binding on them. St. Paul's statement in Romans 2:14 that there is a law written in the hearts, even of Gentiles, who did not know the law, is in full conformity with the Stoic conception, and would for centuries be so understood. Nor during those centuries would the word hearts have merely emotional associations. The Hebrew word which St. Paul represents for heart, or cardia, would be more nearly translated as mind, unquote. Lewis posed similar arguments in his books, The Problem of Pain and Christian Reflections, as you see here. However, like all natural law proponents, he was careful to note that natural law does not afford easy or precise solutions to all questions. Echoing Aristotle, he noted that, quote, moral decisions do not admit mathematical certainty, unquote. Of central importance in Lewis's discussion of natural law is his critique of the moral relativism of utilitarianism as a theory of ethics and guide to behavior. The end justifies the means. Lewis claimed that the precepts of moral ethics cannot just be innovated or improvised as we go along. Picking and choosing among the code of the Tao, or natural law, is inherently foolish and harmful. He noted, for example, that attempts to define moral ethics as the product of a physicalism of survival, as in a Darwinian survival process and instinct, creates a profound dilemma. On the one hand, the utilitarian, or Lewis called this person the innovator, tries to make judgments of the value of human choices by claiming that one decision is good or not. But on what basis is this valuation made if the only standard that exists is instinct? Lewis shows that all such valuations necessarily must use an objective standard of the Tao, or the natural law, to do so, even if only partially. Here's Lewis again, quote, the innovator, the utilitarian, rates high the claims of posterity. He cannot get any valid claim for posterity out of instinct, or in the modern sense, reason, not the same meaning of reason that Lewis uses, by the way. He is really deriving our duty to posterity from the Tao. Our duty to do good to all men is an axiom of practical reason, and our duty to do good to our descendants is a clear deduction from it. But then in every form of the Tao, which has come down to us side by side with the duty to children and descendants, lies the duty to parents and ancestors. But what right do we reject one and accept the other? The innovator, the utilitarian, may place economic value first. To get people fed and clothed is a great end. And in pursuit of it, scruples about justice and good faith may be put aside, according to the innovator. The Tao, of course, agrees with him about the importance of getting the people fed and clothed. Unless the innovator were himself using the Tao, he could never have learned of such a duty to justice and good faith in the first place. But what is his warrant? What is the ground for his pursuit? He may be a jingoist. He may be a racialist, an extreme nationalist, who maintains that the advancement of his own people is the object to which all else ought to yield. But no kind of factual observation and no appeal to instinct will give him a ground for this option. Once more, he is in fact deriving it from the Tao itself. A duty to our own kin, because they are our own kin, is part of the Tao itself, part of traditional morality. But side by side with it in the Tao and limiting it lie the inflexible demands of justice and the rule in the long run that all men are our brothers, not just our kin, unquote. Lewis hence described the natural law as a cohesive and interconnected objective standard of right behavior. Quote, this thing which I've called for convenience the Tao and which others may call natural law or traditional morality or the first principles of practical reason or the first platitudes, is not one among a series of possible systems of value. It is the sole system of value judgments. If it is rejected, all values are rejected. And if any value is retained, it is retained. The effort to refute it and raise a new system of value in its place is self-contradictory. There has never been and never will be a radically new judgment of value in the history of the world. What purport to be new systems, or as they are now called, ideologies, all consist of fragments from the Tao itself. If my duty to my parents is a superstition, then so is my duty to posterity. If justice is a superstition, then so is my duty to my country and my race. If the pursuit of scientific knowledge is a real value, then so is conjugal fidelity, unquote. Lewis then asked, if no new system of value judgment aside for the natural law can be developed, does that mean that there is no progress in our perceptions of value can ever take place? That we are bound forever to an unchanging code given once and for all? If we lump together as, this is Lewis again, as I have done, the traditional moralities of East and West, the Christian, the pagan, and the Jew, shall we not find many contradictions and some absurdities? Unquote. His simple response is, quote, I admit all this. Some criticism, some removal of contradictions, even some real developments is required. But the Nietzschean ethic can be accepted only if we are ready to scrap traditional moralities as a mere error and to put ourselves in a position where we can find no ground for any value judgments at all. From within the Tao itself comes the only authority to modify the Tao. As a proponent of natural law, Lewis was a supporter of what many call the law of equal liberty. But he was a firm critic of imposed egalitarianism for any reason. He further understood that egalitarianism is too often a cloak for envy, the sin of coveting, and that such appeals for regimentation are tyrannical. Quote, the demand for equality has two sources. One of them is among the noblest. The other is the basest of human emotions. The noble source is the desire for fair play. But the other source is the hatred of superiority. Equality, outside of mathematics, is a purely social conception. It applies to man as a political and economic animal. It has no place in the world of the mind. Beauty is not democratic. She reveals herself more to the few than to the many, more to the persistent and discipline seekers than to the many, more to the she is achieved more to the persistent and the seekers than to the careless. Virtue is not democratic. She is achieved by those who pursue her more hotly than most men. Truth is not democratic. She demands special talents and special industry in those to whom she gives her favors. Political democracy is doomed if it tries to extend its demand for equality into these higher spheres. Ethical, intellectual, and aesthetic democracy is death, unquote. He also recognized innate individual human differentiation and how each individual soul is unique as divinely ordained. Quote, it is idle to say that men are of equal value. If value is taken in a worldly sense, if we mean that all men are equally useful or beautiful or good or entertaining, then this is nonsense. If there is equality, it is in his love, not in us. In this way, then, the Christian life defends the single personality from the collective, not by isolating him, but by giving him the status of an organ, and a very productive essential organ, in the mystical body, unquote. Lewis further rejected the determinism of both genetic and environmental causality for mankind. In the so-called modernist perspective, man is not viewed as a moral agent, but as an entity that is conditioned solely for non-practical causes. And all that counts is not what is just, but the utilitarian what works. If man has free will and is considered accountable for his actions, there are limits to the state's power. But if individuals act out of necessity, they are not moral agents. If the place of punishment for wrongdoing, preemption becomes the means of social control. As championed by authoritarians of both left and right, the state simply eliminates the individual's choice, or more exactly, makes the choice for him or her. And this elimination is the basis for the progressive precautionary principle and government measures of prior restraint based on it. Lewis discussed this problem at length in The Abolition of Man, as well as in his various essays, including The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment in God and the Duck. Lewis consequently drew a clear distinction between the reality of the importance for individual liberty and the tendencies to fall prey to the absurdities and dangers of collectivism. He states that, quote, "The first of these tendencies is the growing exaltation of the collective and the growing indifference to persons. If one were inventing a language for sinless beings who love their neighbors as themselves, it would be appropriate first to have words for my, I, and other personal pronouns and inflections. In other words, no difference between two opposite solutions of the problem of selfishness, between love, which is a relation between person, and the abolition of persons. Nothing but a thou can love, and a thou can only exist as an I. A society in which no one was conscious of himself as a person over against other persons, where none could say, I love you, would indeed be free of selfishness, but not through love. It would be unselfish as a bucket of water. In such a case, the individual does not matter, and therefore, when we really get going, it will not matter what you do to an individual, will it? Secondly, we have the emergence of the party in the modern sense. The fascists, the Nazis, the communists. What distinguishes this from the political parties of the 19th century is the belief of its members that they're not merely trying to carry out a program, but obeying an important force, that nature, or evolution, or the dialectic, or the race is carrying them on. This tends to be accomplished by two beliefs. The belief that the process which the party embodies is inevitable, and that the belief of the forwarding of this process is the supreme duty and abrogates all ordinary moral laws. In this state of mind, men can become devil worshippers in the sense that they can now honor as well as obey their own vices. All men at times obey their vices, but it is when cruelty, envy, and lust of power appear as the commands of a great superpersonal force like the dialectic, that they can be exercised with self-approval," unquote. Lewis understood that without this necessary natural law framing of social, legal, and political culture, mankind would no longer be recognized as worthy of rights or even common decency, but instead would be left defenseless to any and all forms of oppression. Here's Lewis again, quote, "For if I'm not deceived, we are all at this moment helping to decide whether humanity shall retain at all that has hitherto made humanity worth pursuing, or whether we must slide down into subhumanity, imagined as Mr. Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, and partially realized in Hitler's Germany," unquote. We hence have the basis for the scientific Brave New World, as Huxley put it, in which the citizen and government become slave and master, exactly what Lewis criticized in his essay, Is Progress Possible? Willing Slaves of the Welfare State, also in his book, God in the Dock. And of course, what all of this means is the elimination of what makes mankind human in the first place. As Lewis explained the problem, the question has become whether we can discover any way of submitting to the worldwide paternalism of a technocracy without losing all personal privacy and independence. Let us make no mistake about the sting. Is there any possibility of getting the super welfare state's honey and avoiding the sting? To live his life in his own way, to call his house his castle, to enjoy the fruits of his own labor, to educate his children as his conscience directs, to save for their prosperity after his death. These are wishes deeply ingrained in civilized man, unquote. This theme, as some of you may know, runs throughout Lewis's work. All of Lewis's work is based on the question of love and what that means. And the theme of liberty is directly related to it. And this theme runs not just throughout his nonfiction, but throughout his fiction. For example, in the third volume in his space trilogy, That Hideous Strength, which you see in the middle, the first two volumes are on the left there, Lewis describes a disturbing world in which a scientific elite at a university creates a totalitarian system in order to coercively engineer a new so-called mankind, a replacement for mankind, via what is called the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments that the central government creates, or NICE as an acronym. The bureaucrats and planners of NICE are exactly what he earlier attacked in his book, The Abolition of Man. And in Lewis's novel, The Screwtape Letters, the demonic Screwtape instructs his pupil, Wormwood, to mislead his pupil, his human patient, by using the convoluted progressive concept of social justice in order to twist what appears to be good into evil and seduces the person into sin. Now remember, in case you haven't read Screwtape Letters, everything Screwtape says is inverted, okay? Here's Screwtape. On the other hand, we do want, and want very much, to make men treat Christianity as a means, preferably, of course, as a means to their own advancement, but failing that, as a means to anything, even to social justice. The thing to do is to get a man at first to value social justice as a thing which the enemy, God, demands, and then work on him to the onto the stage at which he values Christianity, because it may produce social justice. The enemy will not be used as a convenience, unquote. For Lewis, science should be a quest for knowledge, and his concern was that in the modern era, science is too often used instead as a quest by some for power over others. Lewis did not dispute that science is an immensely important tool to understand the natural world. But his larger point is that science cannot tell us anything that is ultimately important regarding what choices we should make. In other words, Lewis showed that what is does not indicate what ought to be. Scientists on their own are not able to address moral ethics, and all social and political questions are exclusively questions of morality. Lewis furthermore viewed as non-science or scientism all those disciplines that attempt to replicate the scientific method to analyze man, just as Hayek wrote, for those of you who read Hayek, in his book, The Counter-Revolution of Science. Here's Lewis again. The new oligarchy must more and more base its claim to plan us on its claim to knowledge. If we are to be mothered, mother must know best. Technocracy is the form in which a planned society must tend. Now, I dread specialists in power because they are specialists speaking outside their special subjects. Let scientists tell us about science. But government involves questions about the good for man and justice and what things are worth having at what price. And on these, scientific training gives a man's opinion no added value, unquote. Lewis, quote, dreaded government in the name of science even more. For him, the connection was clear, quote, that is how tyrannies come in, unquote. Here's Lewis again. In every age, the men who want us under their thumb, if they have any sense, will put forward the particular pretension which the hopes and fears of that age render most potent. We must give full weight to the claim that nothing but science, and science globally applied, and therefore unprecedented government controls, can produce full bellies and medical care for the whole human race. Nothing, in short, but a world welfare state. It is the full admission of these truths which impresses upon me the extreme peril of humanity at present. We have, on the other hand, a desperate need, hunger, sickness, the dread and threat of war. We have, on the other, the conception or of something that might meet it, omnipotent global technocracy. Are not these the ideal opportunity for enslavement? The question about progress has become the question whether we can discover any way of submitting to the worldwide paternalism of a technocracy without losing all personal privacy and independence. All that can happen is that some men will take charge of the destiny of the others. They will be simply men, none perfect, some greedy, cruel, and dishonest. The more completely we are planned, the more powerful they will be. Have we discovered some new reason why this time power should not corrupt as it has done before? Unquote. When the Marxist biology, very prominent biologist, I should mention, J.B.S. Haldane, then questioned Lewis for being anti-science and against a planned world in his space trilogy. He said, "Mr. Lewis's idea is clear enough. The application of science to human affairs can only lead to hell," unquote. Lewis then wrote the following in response, quote, "It certainly is an attack, if not on scientists, yet on something which might be called scientism, a certain outlook on the world which is causally connected with the popularization of the sciences. It is, in a word, the belief that the supreme moral end is the perpetuation of our own species, and that this is to be pursued even if, in the process of being fitted for survival, our species has to be stripped of all those things for which we value it, of pity, of happiness, of freedom. Under modern conditions, any effective invitation to hell will certainly appear in the guise of scientific planning. My fears of such a tyranny will seem to the professor either insincere or pusillanimous. For him, the danger is all in the opposite direction, in the chaotic selfishness of individualism. I must try to explain why I fear more the disciplined cruelty of some ideological oligarchy, which the professor seems to support. The professor has his own explanation of this. He thinks I am unconsciously motivated by the fact that I, quote, stand to lose by social change, unquote. And indeed, it would be hard for me to welcome a change, which might well consign me to a concentration camp, unquote. As the form of government most consistent with the study of natural law and the nature of man, Lewis settled on democracy, not majoritarianism, but self-government, as in Alexis de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America. Considering it the least bad political structure, it should be established only in order to limit decentralized political power and organize through the consent of those involved. Here's Lewis. "I am a Democrat because I believe in the fall of man, or more precisely, that man is free to choose good or evil. He realized, though, that most people are Democrats for the opposite reason." This is Tocqueville. "A great ideal of democratic enthusiasm descends from the ideas of people like Rousseau, who believe in democracy because they thought mankind so wise and good that everyone deserved a share in the government. The danger of defending democracy on those grounds is that they're not true. I find that they're not true without looking further than myself. I don't deserve a share in governing a hen roost, much less a nation. Nor do most people. All the people who believe advertisements and think in catchwords and spread rumors. The real reason for democracy is just, again, the Tocquevillian version, is just the reverse. Man is so fallen that no man can be trusted with unchecked power over his fellows. Aristotle once said that some people were only fit to be slaves, but I reject slavery because I see no men fit to be masters, unquote. In his book, The Weight of Glory, he similarly noted the need to radically constrain the powers of government, paraphrasing Lord Acton's axiom of the corrupting influence of power. Quote, I do not believe that God created an egalitarian world. Since we have sin, we have found, as Lord Acton says, that all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Theocracy has rightly been abolished, not because it is bad that priests should govern ignorant laymen, but because priests are wicked men like the rest of us, unquote. But Lewis fully understood that democracy, if unchecked, becomes egalitarianism and will trample on liberty as a collectivist force for evil by celebrating pride and envy as it fosters tyranny. Lewis's demonic screw tape, this is from the stage play. Lewis's demonic screw tape, this time in Screw Tape Proposes a Toast, once again explains quite eloquently how this very thing has happened historically, even in the supposed pursuit of liberty. Quote, hidden in the heart of the striving for liberty, there has also been a deep hatred of personal freedom. That invaluable man, Rousseau, first revealed it. In his Perfect Democracy, only the state religion is permitted, like our previous speaker pointed. Slavery is restored, and the individual is told that he has really willed, though he didn't know it, whatever the government tells him to do. From that starting point, via Hegel, another indispensable propagandist on our side against this is Screwtape's inversion, right? We easily contrive both the Nazi and the communist state. Even in England, we were pretty successful. I heard the other day that in that country, a man could not, without a permit, cut down his own tree with his own axe, make it into planks with his own saw, and use the planks to build a tool shed in his own garden, unquote. At the root of the developing tyranny are the things many people may least expect, democracy and egalitarianism. Here's Lewis again. Quote, democracy is the word with which you must lead them by the nose. And of course, it is connected with a political ideal that men should be equally treated. You then make a stealthy transition in their minds from this political ideal to a factual belief that all men are equal, especially the man you are working on. And as a result, you can use the magic word democracy to sanction in his thought the most degrading and also the least enjoyable of human feelings. You can get him to practice not only what without shame, but with a positive glow of self-approval, conduct which, if undefended by the magic word, democracy, would be universally derided otherwise. Dunces and idlers must not be made to feel inferior to intelligent and industrial pupils. That would be undemocratic. And anyway, the teachers, or should I say nurses, will be far too busy reassuring the dunces and patting them on the back to waste any time on teaching. This would not follow unless all education became state education. Penal taxes designed for that purpose are liquidating the middle class, the class who are prepared to save and spend and make sacrifices in order to have their children privately educated, unquote. Above all, Lewis was a keen observer of the world he lived in, consistently recognizing the implications of every development in the galloping socialism of post-World War II England. Quote, the political philosophy implicit in modern communities has stolen on us unawares. Two wars created vast curtailments of liberty, and we have grown, though grumblingly, accustomed to our chains. The increasing complexity and precariousness of our economic life have led government to take over many spheres of activity once left to choice or chance. Our intellectuals have surrendered first to the slave philosophy of Hegel, then to Marx, finally to the linguistic analysts. As a result, classical political theory, with its Stoic, Christian, and juristic key conceptions, i.e. natural law, the value of the individual, the rights of man has died. The modern state exists not to protect our rights, but to do us good or to make us good. Anyway, to do something to us or to make us something. Hence the new name leaders for those who are once rulers. We are less their subjects than their wards, pupils, or domestic animals. There is nothing left of which we can say to them, mind your own business. Our lives are their business, unquote. In direct contrast to the moral relativism, utilitarianism, collectivism, and authoritarianism of the progressives, the profound lessons from Lewis's extensive writings pertaining to liberty are really absolutely clear and of the utmost importance to every modern man and woman. Quote, it is in a man's power to treat himself as a mere object of nature, and his object and his judgments of value as raw material for scientific manipulation to alter at will. The real objection is that if man chooses to treat himself as raw material he will be, not raw material to be manipulated as he fondly imagined by himself, but by mere appetite, that is, mere nature, in the person of his dehumanized conditioners. Either we are rational spirit obliged forever to obey the absolute values of the Tao or the natural law, or else we are mere nature to be kneaded and cut into shapes for the pleasures of masters who must, by hypothesis, have no motive but their own natural impulses. Only the Tao provides a common human law of action which can overarch rulers and ruled alike. A dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary to the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny or an obedience which is not slavery. The process, if not checked, will abolish man, goes on apace among communists and Democrats, no less among fascists. The methods may at first differ in brutality, but many a mild-eyed scientist, many a popular dramatist, many an amateur philosopher in our midst means in the long run just the thing as the Nazi rulers of Germany, unquote. In Lewis's book series, The Chronicles of Narnia, the land of Narnia is held in place by the sacred deep magic, or the natural law, and further, the deeper magic, or grace. But to transgress the moral law of the deep magic is to do evil, as the White Witch did. Toward the end of the first book in his series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was made into the highly successful 2005 film, the children Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy assume their rightful thrones as kings and queens of Narnia, but only to do certain things. Lewis described how they govern during the Golden Age of Narnia and their most important accomplishments at the end of the book. Quote, and they made good laws and kept the peace and liberated young dwarfs and young satyrs from being sent to school and generally stopped busybodies and interferes and encourage ordinary people who want to live and let live, unquote. Thank you very much. We have apparently some time for questions, if anyone dares to.
I'm new to C.S. Lewis. I'm wondering what the best place to start with.
Well, I would say the best book to start with would be his book, Mere Christianity. And I would also couple that with reading his book, The Abolition of Man. The Abolition of Man is based on three lectures he gave at Oxford. It's a short book. It's beautifully written. It's a critique which is built very carefully in the book. It's a critique of subjectivism in aesthetics, epistemology, and ethics. But the book will start out, and it will seem kind of a trivial question he asks. By the end of the book, you know exactly why he asks the question.
Yeah, I noticed you spoke of the this is quoted as the practical reason and induction practical reason has a certain rigor of mind will come. So I wonder if Lewis is called possible or possibly going back to Kant.
Well, Lewis was a critic of Kant, so don't get me wrong. Lewis was a scholar of medieval and Renaissance literature. He was actually originally a philosophy professor at Oxford. And the way to understand Lewis, as many of you may know, Lewis was raised in an Anglican home in Northern Ireland, in Belfast. When his mother died at an early age, he had a childhood view of Christianity, abandoned it, became a very firm atheist, later converted, in the course of becoming a professor, when he became a Christian, everything fell into place as far as his worldview. So his field was medieval Renaissance literature, and what he would do is he was literally immersed into that worldview of how you thought. And he was able to look at the modern world from that perspective. And that gave him a great advantage. Tolkien also had a similar, his best friend Tolkien. And so Lewis was not, I mean, Lewis saw value in certain modern philosophers, post-Enlightenment philosophers, Locke and others, but he also saw limits. He saw problems with them. So Kant was one of the ones he found problems with.
Mine is just a footnote. My comment is just a footnote. Nice presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a wonderful passage in the Tocqueville towards the end of the second major part where he talks about, just like you did, about the scientism and the way in which a planned state over time just simply starts to take over everything. So they begin to tell us how to farm, what to manufacture, and how much, and how to engage in education, how to raise our children until eventually they just take over everything. So it's just a footnote to some of the nice comments you made about
CSM. Well, thank you. I think that's exactly right. One other point about Tocqueville is that Tocqueville came to the United States with one of his colleagues, and his mission was to study the American penal system. So they were traveling around, you know, looking at prisons and so forth. And to his surprise, he discovered that in all these towns and villages, the social organization was based on, if a problem existed, people would form these voluntary organizations to build a house that burned down or helping someone who had contracted some disease or whatever it might be. It was a spontaneous process of community flexibility and innovation. And he was just amazed by this. And this is what inspired his book, Democracy in America. And one of the reasons he was so amazed by this was because, as you were saying, in France, none of this happened. Because everything had to be approved by the king. They had a system of so-called mercantilism, and even worse than mercantilism. And so you were not able to respond. It was all a state-planned deal. And the French Revolution, which was inspired by the Enlightenment, led to Napoleon, of course, and was not a critique of statism. It was basically a critique of the monarchy, and they were going to replace it by a secular state, scientifically, secularly based. And, of course, you had the outcome, as we've seen.
My question may be too negative to be considered. I wonder what you just described as what the community did. Did they only do it out of necessity because there was no other framework? And as society then progressed and then you were able to have a government, people said, okay, now you do it. We don't have to do it.
Are you talking about who again?
What you just talked about with what?
Yeah.
When he saw that the community
would
do what needed to be done, was it because it was, you know, frontier or pioneer spirit where there just was no other framework to get these necessary things done?
Well, they
can exist.
They created the frameworks. They created private, voluntary institutions was the difference. Now, one thing I might mention about this is that A lot of people, as was mentioned earlier this morning, can't imagine what the world would be like without the welfare state. The view would be people would starve in the streets and so forth. And that's total baloney. What existed before the welfare state was a very complex system of tens of thousands of mutual aid societies in America and in England. And these were organizations that people pulled together, and they would pool their resources to create insurance schemes for unemployment and disability and for old age and so on and so forth. If they needed the assistance, they would then turn to it. But if they didn't, they wouldn't, because they were part of this enterprise. And these were very efficient. In fact, the most effective of these groups were organized by people who were the most discriminated against. African-American groups, groups by new immigrants, were some of the most successful, most extensive mutual aid societies. Far more effective, and really very much in keeping with what Tocqueville was talking about. So the alternative to socializing institutions or socializing authority in a command and control way is to have private institutions that are planned and so forth and endure, but are not based on coercion or compulsion.
Again, just as a follow-up, you still see that today in very well-organized churches, where what happens is a lot of what we think of as social welfare gets structured through the church, which is marvelous, because what happens is it bonds people to the church, bonds people to Christ and to the community. And both those who give and those who receive. So it's not at all unusual in my parish, for example, for my priest to call me up and say, hey, we've got somebody who really needs help. I won't tell you who it is, but I vetted it. This is somebody who comes to church, and I need this much now. I'm calling 10 people. I've got to have it. And the reason is again, I have to give and they receive. And it's just like mutual aid. It's just a marvelous way of doing things that bonds people together in these small institutions much better than the state.
Yeah, well, I'm about to be pulled off the stage. Yeah. But I'll just make one quick further point. And that's that there's one of the papers also on our table is a paper called Secular Theocracy. And it's important to realize that where you have these decentralized institutions and social arrangements which were faith-based. But if you're not faith-oriented, you know, you're not coerced to participate, but most people would join them. The post-Enlightenment rise of society was the insistence on the nation-state, centralized authority, and the advocacy of this by Voltaire and Gibbon and many others was you want a secular state. The secular state pushes religion and Christianity itself to the periphery of society because it was viewed as a danger. And I would encourage you to take a look at that article by me, which draws on some of the same authors, including Lewis. But it frames essentially what we're having to deal with. We're basically facing, in the modern era, secular statism. And as Lewis said, we should be against all forms of theocracy, including secular theocracy. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for listening to that address. I very much hope that you got as much out of it as I did. As always, details about the podcast can be found in the show notes, which can be accessed at themindrenewed.com. As I always say, when I mention the website, it's not MindRenewed, it's themindrenewed.com. I always have a link on the podcast page to the show notes. You'll find a yellow folder icon with a blue information circle. If you click on that, it will take you through to the show notes for each show. Next week, all being well, we shall be speaking with Dr. Robert H. Bennett, who is guest professor of missions at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and also the executive director of Luther Academy in the same area. And I'll be speaking with him about his academic research into the subject of demon possession and spiritual warfare in the context of Madagascar, and how that might help to inform our own spiritual understandings here in the West. And finally, let me say, if you are a new listener to this podcast, please do check out the archive at themindrenewed.com. I can now officially say that there are 100 shows to investigate on many different subjects, many of which are, I believe, as relevant today as they were when they were first posted. So thanks for listening. Do take care, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future.